Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Ross Ferguson. It's been a little while, hasn't it?
It's been a while, and it's been so long that one, it's now dark in the mornings again. We were doing afternoons, but two, someone's done something to my microphone.
Yeah, having some mic issues this morning.
It's really tall.
It looks pretty janky.
And this is how long it's been that someone's messed up with my microphone.
It looks like it's been cobbled together from different parts.
It does look like that.
Right? It's like someone's just stuck things together. It looks like a Lego microphone.
I feel like I should take a picture of this so that when this episode comes out, people can see what is going on with my microphone.
Well, you know, we're saying, you know, I say, it's been a while. Listeners are like, what do you mean? You're on every week. But we've had two recording sessions. Two that we've had to cancel because of snow and ice and other things. So you and I have not been in the booth for a little while.
And you've been preaching away and I've been preaching away. Yeah. So I feel like even in this last 6 weeks that we haven't seen each other in the normal times either. So.
We have not. Well, it's a mailbag episode. So let's jump right in without any further ado. This question comes from Brian on Facebook. Brian says, what first steps would you recommend for a church and a pastor that's just installed its first lay elders? First steps for those churches that have just installed its first lay elders. You have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two things and two sides I would say is one for the elders and then one for the congregation. So just because they've just been installed, it's kind of like, yeah, we did it. We got them in. Let's go. You shouldn't assume that then everything is going to be perfect and everything is going to flow well. You should still continue to look at development of those elders. They haven't, quote, made it. They are still serving. So therefore, you want to be maybe thinking about introducing training for them or introducing books you're going to read or reviews at 6 months or something that you can just say, this isn't, quote, we've made everything happen. It's all good. But actually, it's a continual development. The fact that he said, their first lay elders.
Yeah.
So not assuming that everything's going to run perfectly. And then on the congregation side, most of the times when you install lay elders, there is still some friction. There's still some uncertainty. What's this going to look like? How's this going to flow? So always err on caution. So more communication, slower processes, getting feedback from people, continuing to pray for elders, continuing to pray for the situation, and just allow the congregation to get used to it. Like any change, it jars sometimes, and it's going to take a while, especially if there's been guys that have sat as deacons and they're no longer deacons and they're elders, or the deacons have stepped off now. There might be some in the church that feel just a little bit like, well, what do I do now? Because I've been so used to this role.
Yeah.
So I think it's that sounds really exciting. I'm really glad that they're moving in this direction, but just don't assume that everything's going to go swimmingly well. In fact, prepare into that and move into that.
Yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned deacons. One thing in particular is if you had an existing, you know, leadership team of some kind, in a lot of churches, it's the board of deacons or a deacon, you know, deacon team. And now you've established multiple elders. Even if you've pulled from that deacon team or not, certain people to become elders, if you haven't already, one thing you need to do, I think, is communicate as clearly as possible the division of labor, the division of authority, where elders have authority, and because that can be one of the most jarring transitions, especially for deacons who have had a kind of pastoral authority as overseers or something like that. If they suddenly don't have that anymore, this happened at my last church, and I was told it might happen. I remember talking to Jonathan Lehman, and I was like, hey, we're about to establish lay elders. It's the first time this church has had plurality of elders. What are some things that I need to think about? And he said, you need to be careful that you don't end up with a, you know, default bicameral legislature of some kind where it's sort of like, and I was like, oh, that won't happen here. And sure enough, it wasn't the whole of the deacons, but there were a couple that suddenly there were things they didn't get to vote on anymore and things that they weren't in control of anymore. And they really struggled with that. So if you haven't already kind of laid that groundwork out, being able to communicate with your existing deacons or whoever was kind of you know, making leadership decisions that are now being ceded to these elders. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is if you haven't already, and to some extent you may not be able to until guys have come into the role of a pastor, is lay out a really good plan for pastoral care. What will these guys do? Mm-hmm. How are you, you know, for lack of a better word, dividing up the congregation that the, you know, congregation might be cared for by these pastors? Give them something to do so they're not just every month or every couple of weeks showing up to some meeting and just hearing you kind of lay out everything that you're doing, right? You know, give them something that they can report on as soon as possible. You know, come up with a pastoral care plan. Even if you pastor are the only staff pastor or the only, you know, vocational elder, and so you're doing the bulk of it, these guys need to be in the mix of congregational care. And as lay elders, they won't be able to do as much as you perhaps, but they need to be doing some. And so figure out what that plan is.
I would almost say that if you're like the lead pastor, lead preaching pastor, whatever, you want to make that title, don't be the chair of those meetings.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I think it can be really easy as the lead pastor, senior pastor, preaching pastor, whatever you want to call it, to just kind of run off and to be like, this is what I'm doing. This is all the things we're doing. Give me your reports. You're not actually in charge. So trying to say to your lay elders, do you know what? One of you is really good with administrative skills, note-taking, minute-taking, keeping us on track. You're going to chair our meetings so that you can have one of those elders say, hey, lead pastor, you're kind of on a rant. Can you stop now so we can get on with these things? So from a ministry perspective, that can be a really encouraging thing to the church as well. So it doesn't look like the senior pastor's padding the team so it fits with him. And actually, no, this is more about getting the best team with the best skills in the best places.
Yeah. The other thing that I would mention to you, Brian, is to make sure you get them as visible as possible, you know, just because they're not on staff and may not be you know, preaching every week or something like that. What can you do to get them up in front of people in the weekend service, you know, pastoral prayer, giving announcements, leading in different ways, and referring to them as pastor so-and-so, or if in your church, you know, it's more appropriate to say elder so-and-so, whatever, you know, use that kind of language just so you're getting in front of the congregation that these guys are pastors, that they're pastors with you, you know, have them visible. Give them that title, refer to them as Pastor so-and-so. That can go a long way with the congregation of communicating, hey, they have, you know, these are your shepherds too. And they may not, you know, carry the same weight as the vocational guy, but they're pastors just like the vocational guy is a pastor. So those are some things you can kind of think through. Yep. Anything else you want to add there?
No, that sounds good.
All right. So this comes from Bashir on Facebook. I think I'm saying his name right. Maybe Basher. Bashir on Facebook says, should pastors run for political office? Do you believe that a pastor can effectively shepherd his flock and be a politician as well? Well. Okay. Yeah. So, I'm guessing you've got some thoughts on this.
I have some thoughts on this. So I think context matters. So if you go to somewhere like Northern Ireland, you would have had Ian Paisley. And Ian Paisley was a pastor, a very outspoken Christian, and served as a politician for decades. Here's the thing, though. He was known as the fiery politician rather than the fiery pastor.
Oh, interesting.
I think whenever you do something bivocationally, because there's no way you can be a full-time pastor and a full-time politician, the reality is you're doing a bivocation here. When you do that, you're always going to split your time. And something like politics is going to overwhelm, usually, your 20 hours a week or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's not that I don't think you can't be involved in politics. I don't think there's anything that necessarily would stop you. I'm not thinking of anything biblical that can make me go, absolutely don't do politics. I would be seriously concerned about someone running for politics because a political position, because I'm not entirely sure how compatible it is with the pastoral role.
Yeah.
So I think this is personal preference. I would guide people to choose one or the other.
It's interesting the way Bashir phrases the question, because if he had said, can pastors run for political office, I'm not aware of any restriction on that, I would say.
Depending on political party, political viewpoint, let's assume that you're running for a political office where you can continue to hold your Christian beliefs. Let's just kind of assume
that. Assuming all that, you know, we don't want to create any extra biblical laws here. Yep. We don't want to be legalists. So we'd say, yeah, they can. He says should. And I'm just going to say no.
No.
Yeah. Can they? Sure. Should they? I don't think so. Yeah. And that's a personal preference. That, again, that's not me saying this is what the Bible says. This is just.
Yeah.
And every time I have seen this happen where there's a pastor who's also yep. If you look at his public facing broadcast,
yeah.
it is usually 95% politics
yep.
and maybe 5% Jesus. Yeah. And I just think that's telling.
Yeah.
There's just something when you mix these things, politics just seems to absorb everything.
Yeah.
And I think it very often, I'm not saying it's impossible for this not to happen, but very often the political interest outweighs mm-hmm. it, because you've got to keep up, you know, with your constituency, yeah. you want to maintain your public office, et cetera. And it just seems like you're having to, yep. you know, be a divided person. You're in these two different yeah. worlds, and one invariably swallows up the yeah, other one. So can they? Sure. And I'm sure maybe there's somebody out there who's doing it well, and yeah. we'll hear from people saying, you know, my pastor's a congressman and everything's great, you know. But I just,
yeah,
my personal viewpoint is it's not a great idea.
I think there are some offices that are political in nature, but you could potentially do it. So I'm just thinking of like public school boards and things like that.
I think
in theory you could do those things. Again, it's the same dangers though. You're going to get, your life is going to be swallowed up by those things. And from a political perspective, sure, you can hold Christian beliefs, but we all know there's pressure consistently to support other things. And just even, we served in a really small town in North Dakota. All the local towns had mayors. Each mayor would then support that local town. So if you were a pastor and a mayor, then you're going to have to support every single religious organization in your town because that's what's required of the mayor.
Yeah, yeah.
So that means you're going to have to be a proponent of the Catholic Church. You're going to have to be a proponent of, if the mosque gets put up, you're going to have to be proponents of these things because you can't be seen as closing these things down because that's what your town is. So I just think it's one of those things of you're asking for trouble by running for political office while being a pastor. Choose one and do what the Lord calls you to do. If it's political office, do it for the Lord. If it's a pastor, do it for the Lord.
Yeah, okay. This comes from Greg. Greg via email. He says, how about some thoughts on how to advance a vision of church health while the average Christian appetites are not calibrated toward church health, and most other local church options recognize this and cater to it. So here's his shorter version. He actually provides this, not me. He says, shorter version, how do I cultivate healthy church appetites without seeming like a curmudgeon in our current Christian climate? Well, I'm just going to assume some of these things that Greg is talking about, he's not specific about appetites for what or appetites about something. I'm going to assume for, you know, deep study of the word, for community, those sorts of things, which, you know, he mentions other church options that don't seem to cater toward or cater towards unhealthy appetites. And I'm picturing churches that are consumeristic and mm-hmm. pragmatic and that sort of thing. And Greg, you know, my answer is somewhat short other than, you know, how do you do it without seeming like a curmudgeon? The way to seem like a curmudgeon would be to always be critiquing everybody else that's out there and casting a negative vision of how we're not going to be like that and you should not be like that and you need to be healthy and not, you know, unhealthy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you got to do that in the right measure. That's just part of, you know, the prophetic edge of being a pastor. But I think largely so, you need to cast a positive vision simply by modeling it. Just preach well, lead in community. It's one thing to just tell people you need to be healthier. You need to have better appetites, right? It's another thing to actually cultivate that over time. You use the word advance, right? And then cultivate. Cultivate, I think, is the right word there. And it's not something you can do overnight. It's not a matter of just denouncing something and then pronouncing something. You actually have to model this, and you just have to, over time, be trusting that the Holy Spirit is working through the alternative version.
Yeah.
And brother, it could be, I mean, it's very often that's not as attractive in a lot of contexts, in a lot of cultural or, you know, regions. And your thing may not grow as much as others, and you're just going to be stuck with this idea of like, oh, these people don't have the appetites they ought to. And that's, you know, that may be the case. But you need to keep with it so that sometimes we have to acknowledge that healthy church, the church, you know, church that is healthy isn't necessarily really big.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I was just thinking that even just reading the question feels negative.
Okay.
And one of the things that I think in gospel centrality, one of the things that we want to promote and want to encourage is the gospel's beautiful and we don't need to add stuff to it. And to some extent, let's apply that to then church health. What is beautiful in church health that you can promote, that you can encourage people on? So when you talk about healthy membership, are you talking about when it's not healthy, how bad that is? Or are you talking about, hey, I want to really encourage us to join together? You know, it's the tone of voice, it's the approach to it. And I was just thinking about this in terms of parenting. You can be a parent that says no 9 times and yes 1 time. Or you can be a parent that says 5 no's and 5 yeses, and you're trying to kind of teach your children there is no's and there is yeses, and we're trying to encourage you into the kind of positive way of living, into the correct way of living. So I want to almost reword this question and ask the question, why do you think being a healthy church is a good thing for your church? Tell them that. Encourage them that. Walk alongside them. Say things like, I'm saddened by this because I can see, quote, this positive way of going. Where if you just go, well, other churches don't care about it, people don't seem to care about it, I seem to be on my own, how can I not be a curmudgeon? You're kind of almost thinking about it in a curmudgeon way. Can you think about it in a different way of, I love my church, I dearly want them to be healthy, I can see fruits of that some places. How could I encourage more fruit in that? How can I encourage us to keep going down this line? I think this might be a tonal thing of just thinking about how you can guide your church in a way that they see you as a doctor, as a shepherd, as someone that's consistently trying to encourage them, help them get healthy, and where are you pointing them to? I would almost say, ignore what other churches are doing. It's not your flock that you're to care for. The flock is in front of you. Look at them entirely and see how you can lead them to the still waters. The Psalm chapter 1 talks about, and plant that church right by those still waters.
Yeah. You know, if you don't want to seem like a curmudgeon, Greg, as I said, then don't be constantly critiquing everything that's out there. You know, as Ross was saying, maybe you don't need to be focusing on those, you know, rival options and, you know, so on. So, you know, cast that positive vision and just lead, you know, positively and trust the Lord will be using that.
We would like to take a moment to invite you to campus for our Spring Preview Day on April 11th. Preview Day is a great way to explore how you can be trained in your calling for the church and for the kingdom. At Preview Day, you'll get a behind-the-scenes look at what life at Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College would look, including mock lectures, meeting seminary leaders, and connecting with current students on campus. Whether you're interested in online or residential studies, we hope you'll consider joining us for Preview Day. Reserve your spot at mbts.edu/preview. And who knows, you might just run into myself and Jared.
Okay, this comes from Jacob on Facebook. I really like this question. Jacob on Facebook says, my question is, if the church has put guidelines forward on who should or should not partake of the Lord's Supper, for example, that someone would need to be a Christian and a member of a church or a baptized believer, how would you go about guarding the table if an individual came forward to receive the Lord's Supper if you knew that they were not adhering to those guidelines? Would you allow them to go ahead and partake since they came forward? Or would you refuse to serve them? And if so, how would you go about that? I laugh about the question. It's a very good question.
It's a very good question.
I laugh about it because in the pastoral ministry course, when we get to the ordinances, we talk about fencing the table, which is usually a traditional term for essentially giving the parameters for who should and should not receive the Lord's Supper. Call it fencing the table. And for some students, this is the first they've ever heard of this thing. They've been in churches that practice either open communion or they just don't clearly communicate what communion is really all about. And when you talk about, you know, fencing the table, they're thinking like literally you're smacking elements out of people's hands and things like that. And depending on how, you know, what your process is, you may not be able to prevent this. Like in some churches where you pass the plate, you know, you can fence the table, and all that means is you're giving the biblical warning, caution, you're giving the parameters. This is who the meal is for and who the meal is not for.
Yeah.
But when you pass those plates out, you cannot control over who's going to be you know, to use the biblical language, eating and drinking judgment upon themselves if they're partaking in an unworthy manner. You just can't control that. In our church, people do come forward, but it, you know, we have volunteers who are serving at the, you know, at the supper tables. And so we're not going to have them adjudicate who's coming, you know, who's, you know, should be, you know, handed that bread and cup, you know, they're just, if someone's in line, they're going to give it to them. Yeah. So, you know, there still will be people who, you know, partake in an unworthy manner, so to speak. I can think a few weeks back, there was a young lady who actually approached me. I was, you know, standing in the front row, approached me during the, you know, the communion time. And she basically like briefly explained, you know, that she's scheduled to be baptized, that she made a profession of faith and she was scheduled to be baptized. And she asked, is it okay if I, you know, take the Lord's Supper? And I just said, no, you need, you know, to wait and I'll, and that was it. And then afterwards I followed up with her to kind of explain and make sure she was okay and all that. And she is, and she, you know, now she's been baptized and she partakes. But like, if you were, I'll just ask you, Ross, if you were the one as a pastor who was administering these elements and someone came forward that you know is not a believer, or maybe they're a member of your church, but they're not in good standing. They're in conflict with, or there's, you know, unrepentant sin. They're a church discipline case, something like that. Would you give them the elements or would you?
I would pronounce Old Testament judgment on them and come down. No, I joke. I think this is, I think this is a phenomenal question because I think actually when push comes to shove, I would want to try and stop the individual taking of them elements, but I don't quite know how to do that in the moment because I don't think I've ever had to. So the thing in my mind is, number one, Spurgeon gave out tickets. So you couldn't take communion unless you handed in your ticket.
Yeah.
And so all the elders, I don't personally like that idea. You know, like,
but you can see the logic in it.
I can see the logic because what you're saying is pre the service, we're making sure everyone can take it. I think if it's someone that's been part of our church for a while, I'm probably going to talk to them ahead of it. And hopefully they heed the advice ahead of it.
Yeah.
What I think is the struggle is when we have guests.
Right.
So at Liberty, we'll say something like, if you're a guest, you can partake. If you're in membership and you're in good stead with that membership in another church.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know that.
We have no idea if that's true or not.
But here's the two things that I keep thinking. Is it our responsibility to ensure that every single person that's taking communion is doing it in a healthy manner? Because even if someone, quote, had the ticket and has been approved by a pastor, are we still sure that they're taking it in a worthy manner? Because in their heart, they might absolutely hate the pastor and want his demise. Well, that's an unworthy manner. You cannot hate a brother and love Christ. So it's that kind of a, is it our responsibility? Well, I think there is a level of responsibility that we want to do our very best. But I think ultimately, vengeance belongs to the Lord. If you drink and eat in an unworthy manner, that is before the Lord. We shouldn't be actively trying to go, who cares? Anyone can have it.
Yeah.
I think there's just a limit of what we can do, spiritually speaking, even. To answer your question originally, no, I would not smack the elements out of someone's hand. But I would do exactly, I think, what you have done in this situation. Actually, I was there that Sunday that you did this, that you want to have a gentle word at the same time. That individual went, oh, well, I'm going to take it anyway. Like, do you go up to the person and say, don't
you
give them the elements? Like, what do you do? There is a level that we have to remember that the pastor is not a dictator. We are a shepherd. We do the very best by the flock before us. And at times there's going to be situations that we have to say, Lord, let it be, let it be under you. So it's kind of a soft answer.
The question comes from a place that I almost wonder. Because if you have guests, you don't know. Like you're saying, you know, if you're visiting with us, you're welcome to take at the table if you're a baptized believer and you're a member in good standing. And like you said, if they're guests, you may not know. Yeah. The question is phrased as if you do know. Yeah. And I wonder if this is coming from a place. There's somebody who's regularly receiving communion
if you
that
do
you know,
know
should not.
Yeah, if you do know, you definitely need to stop.
And that does not mean, Jacob, that as they're in line, you go and intercept them and pull them out. But it does mean you have a conversation with them.
Definitely.
If you know this is a pattern to say, hey, look, I noticed that you're doing it. You know, you don't have to be mean or, you know, harsh about it. Let's just say, hey, I've noticed that you go forward. Let's talk about that because we have particular rules here. And one thing that I try to do when I'm administering the ordinances, you know, and fencing the table per se, is when I, you know, say who it's not for and I ask people to refrain if they do not meet these criteria, I try to say, you know, something like, this is a family meal. It's very precious to us. It's very sacred to us because some folks won't understand. They're like, well, You know, why can't I just do it anyway? Yeah. You know, it's not that big a deal. I'm trying to explain, like, out of respect for us, because this is so precious to us, would you mind refraining? I try to put it kind of that way sometimes, because I think some folks will be like, oh, just out of religious respect, I don't want to disrespect you. And, you know, some people will do it anyway, but, you know, that's one way to kind of gently maybe approach it. You might do that with this person, is just to say, hey, this is really sacred to us. And in a way, it's kind of disrespecting what we think about it, even if you don't think that way about it. It's like you're in our home and you're, you know, eating food that we're saying is just for, you know, grandpa or something. I mean, you know, I don't know. There's a way to probably do it gently.
Little bit of a tangent here, but just thinking about the fact that baptism, if you don't view baptism as doing anything, Peter specifically talks about it. It's not washing the dirt off you, physical dirt. It's not a bath time. Yeah. Do you know, like, baptism represents something. It means something. If you're not a believer and you go and partake of the elements in communion, and let's say, you know, a guest is coming, we know they're not baptized, we know they're not a believer, is it just the situation, hey, it's not doing anything for you? As in, I'm thinking about the judgment of eating in an unworthy manner is a believer who is potentially indisciplined, potentially behaving incorrectly, eating in an incorrect manner. Well, there is judgment on that. Is there judgment on the individual that partakes who is not a Christian, who just kind of views it like, well, baptism just washes you, so I guess I can just eat these elements and move on? Do you know, does that make sense of what I'm asking?
I think that it is, because it's sort of a, it's a almost kind of blasphemy. It's a, it's a disrespecting, it's a, you know, it's not just an ambivalence. It's a, I'm being told this represents, whether you believe that or not, or have, you know, if you have an unregenerate heart, even, you're in some ways defiling the meal by partaking of it. So you're compounding the judgment, the wrath of God that's against you, you know?
And that's how we should communicate to the person before the communion, is saying, like, I know that you might not think this is a big deal, but it is a big deal.
Yeah.
And it is a big deal to us that we don't want you to be under that judgment, and we don't want you to be there. So could you not partake today, and let's meet together this week and talk about this? And I think this is where you end up, you have to either decide that the partaking of communion and those elements is sacred and it's really important, or you have to go down the line of, it's just something we do. And whichever way you go down, and I'm not, you know, it's clear what we want you to go down, you're going to respond differently. If it's not that important, you're just going to leave the person taking it. If it's super important, gently, and that's the key word, gently, you need to deal with it.
Yeah. You know, the last part of his question essentially saying, would you allow them to go ahead and partake? And I think if the pastor, if you are the one actually administering the elements, I think I could see myself, if I know, I'm, you know, I'm not like making a nuanced judgment call on every single person who's coming up, but you know, someone is not a believer, or you know, they're in wanton sin, and they come up even after these warnings and even after conversations, I could see saying, hey, I'm not going to give this to you, and we can talk about it later. But and maybe that causes a scene, I don't know. But yes, I could see a situation where you would refuse to give them, right? He says, would you refuse to serve them? I can see if you're one administering, I'm not going to put that on a volunteer or anything like that. Yeah. But yes, I could see refusing to serve them. All right, this comes from Art via email. And he's got a lot of backstory. It was a rather long email. Art, that's not me complaining. I'm just saying we can't read the entire backstory, but it involves essentially views of alcohol. Yeah. So essentially, Art is saying that there was a time when he abstained from partaking of alcohol, but now is exercising his Christian liberty to partake of alcohol. But he has a friend from his old days. I think I'm getting this backstory correct.
Yep.
He has a friend from his old days who is still a teetotaler who does not partake of alcohol. Okay. And so, okay, you got all that. This is what he says. My concern is if this topic were to come up, the topic of alcohol, my friend might be confused, since I'm almost certain that teetotalism is where he still draws the line. What advice might you guys have for a fellow like me, one who doesn't share the same strict views on the consumption of alcohol that my friend does? I'd hate for this to create a wedge, but I don't want to be dishonest or hide anything from my brother. Here we go handling a grenade for this Southern Baptist Seminary podcast.
Yeah. I mean, this is when I saw this question, I was like, this has been kind of my life. This has been one of those things that have come up quite multiple times.
You're on the teetotaler
I'm
side.
I'm on the teetotaler side, not for theological reasons, but for personal reasons. My backstory is that my father was an alcoholic and alcohol was always a very, very negative thing in our lives. So my brother and I have abstained and remained teetotalers. And therefore, in our, like, I even have a strict rule that I won't even allow it in our house. So even if somebody brought it to our house, wherever we lived on campus, you're not allowed it anyway. So, but wherever we lived, I don't even allow it in our house. And that's a very strict viewpoint. And that is purely because of my background. And so I want to talk less about the theology, about where they land. What you have here is two friends that land on a different scale on either side. This could have been any subject matter, any theological matter. What we have is two good friends that sit on the opposite side, and partly because of a change. Let me speak from the teetotaler side. One of the things that I find difficult, and I think most teetotalers would, is when you have a really good friend who does drink alcohol and does it in front of you and doesn't know that might ever be an issue. And what I mean by that is I have been at a meal with somebody and then they've had two glasses of wine. And that just generally makes me feel uncomfortable. And that's just because of my background. I try to avoid it. I try to not be around it. And that's something that I've had to work through. So if you have a really good friend who's a teetotaler who really doesn't like being around it, the question I want to ask you is, as a friend, are you willing to forgo those drinks around that individual? Now, that individual might turn around, and there has been occasions where I've turned around and said, hey, I know you like a glass of wine. It's fine. Don't worry about it. But that's been after years of working through this. So you almost want to go, you can't change the other person. So Art, you can't change how your friend views alcohol. He has his view. How can you be a really good friend to him? You can say to him, and I think you got to be honest. Hey, I've changed my views on alcohol. I know you haven't. I want to just say this to you, brother. I'm not going to drink around you. This is my personal thing, but I don't want to offend you or hurt you. But this is where I land now. Also though, the teetotaler has to recognize if you have made that choice for you, you cannot force that on another person.
Yeah.
And so what you have a world here is Philippians 2. To consider the other person more than you, to put them higher more than you, which means the one that drinks alcohol is saying, I don't want to drink before you, brother, because I know that's your view and I don't want to offend you, I don't want to hurt you. I'm not going to hide it from you because I'm worried that Art might be trying to hide it from his friend. And then the teetotaler is going, look, this is my personal conviction. I would prefer not to go to restaurants. I prefer not to have it in my home, but I totally understand that you drink. I'm okay with that. Could I just ask that you don't drink too much in front of me? Like there's the considering one another here.
Yeah.
If you lose a friendship over something like this, you never had a friendship in the first place. And I would say this is on a lot of issues, but for me personally, I started with the, I never want to go near alcohol. I don't want to touch it. I don't want to be around it. It has taken me 20 years to be comfortable to be in a restaurant and sit with someone having a glass of wine or a beer. If I see someone drinking more than that, I become very uncomfortable because my past is seeing someone drink multiple things and things go bad after that. And so most of my friends understand that. And most of my friends want to protect and guard that for me. At the same time, I'm so glad that the Lord has brought me on a journey that I'm no longer 20 years ago saying, don't you dare drink in front of me. I'm going, I get it. You sit on a different side than me. So I want to say to you, love your brother. Tell him how you feel. Tell him the changes. Let him argue with you. He's probably going to try and convince you because that's what they do. But think Philippians 2. How can you consider his needs? How can you live in that way? You can't change him. He might not do this to you. But my encouragement possibly would be don't drink around him until you know that your friendship is in a good place to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I think this is almost a textbook application of the weaker brother sort of situation.
I agree.
And I'm sure your friend Art would consider you the weaker brother for quote unquote giving in or compromising, on this view. And that's fine. But you can consider him the weaker brother. And in that case, if you know this, obviously you don't drink around him and you need to be able to Put that aside. If you're not able to not drink around summit, then
that's a problem.
Then that's an idolatry issue. But the way Art describes it, this is not, yeah. you know, he just, you know, partakes
it's
it
an
you know,
occasion
every now and again. It. It's an occasion, that sort of thing. And he also doesn't say, like, I want to drink around him. He basically yeah. says, if the topic were to come up.
Yeah.
So I think it's more of an issue of, like, conversationally knowing that they have different views. And, you know, Art, I agree, you don't want to be dishonest or hide anything. I just, you know, don't bring it up. You don't have yeah. to bring up the subject. You don't have to parade your liberty, even if you're not drinking. You don't have to bring up the conversation.
Yeah.
If your friend is bringing up the conversation and it's done in such a way that he's just, you know, going against alcohol or talking about how people who drink, you know, are compromised or what have you, maybe you just bear that gladly, yeah. cheerfully. You don't have to go back at him.
yeah.
You know, I agree with you. You don't necessarily need to feel like you got to hide something or be yeah. dishonest or but, you know, sometimes when I disagree with somebody on some other issue and they're going off about people who believe such and such, and I actually believe that,
yeah.
sometimes I just let them go and I'm like, yep. it's not worth getting in an argument yep. about. I don't want to. So just let them yeah. say what they want to say. Now, if he were to ask you, don't you agree or something?
You say,
you don't need to lie. You can just say, no, I don't agree with yeah. that. But
we're still friends. Don't worry yeah. about it. I had a guy where in my mid-20s, I saw him drink a beer and I was really shocked. I'd known him, you know, 15 years, really shocked. I remember saying to him, you know, that's beer, kind of like what are you
doing?
Do you
know what you're doing?
Yeah. And he said, yeah. And I just looked at him and went, I don't think I've ever seen you. And this was his words. I still remember. He said, I always knew that you had a problem with anyone drinking around you. So I just chose not to drink around you. You're 25 now. I think you can handle it. And it was just that he lovingly said,
yeah.
I'm just not going to deal this with you. He knew that I was angry. He knew I was frustrated. He knew I was struggling with it because of my childhood. And he just went, you know what? I'm just not going to engage in with it around him. Mm. But when you're an adult,
yeah.
you kind of got to pull your socks up and deal with it. So there's an element. Yeah. Or just when it comes up, have a good conversation. Love your brother. And read through the whole chapter of Philippians 2. I think that might help you.
All right. All right. Final question. This comes from Benjamin. Benjamin was so eager to get this question across. He so wants you to answer this question. Or maybe me too. I don't know.
Yeah.
He sent it via Facebook and email. He was doubling up so we wouldn't miss it. Benjamin wants to know, is Iron Brew's color deceptive? Is Iron Brew's color deceptive? How would you describe Iron Brew, of course, is the Scottish soda. Scottish?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Scottish soda that Ross really enjoys. And yeah. sometimes he gets it specially shipped, or he has to go to specialty soda places to find it over here. And I guess he's asking the question because it has a
bright orange,
like a radioactive orange color.
It's bright orange.
And then it tastes like it should be pink almost.
Okay.
I think.
So here's my answer.
Because like, people have said it tastes like bubble gum or something like that.
Well, again, this always frustrates me. Iron Brew was invented before bubble gum. So technically, okay. bubble gum tastes like Iron Brew.
Okay, all right.
I just want to put that out there. Most people say it's like Big Red.
Yeah, it does taste like Big Red. If you're familiar with that, so it tastes like Big Red.
My answer is yes and no. So to Scottish people, uh-huh. it's not deceptive whatsoever because we look at the color and go, that's Iron Brew. And we know what it tastes like. So there's an element of like you, whatever your hometown drink is, your country drink or whatever, you know exactly by the color, by the look, what it tastes like. So to Scottish people, Iron Brew just tastes like Iron Brew. to Americans, they see orange and think orange soda. They think Fanta. They think something like that. But it's more when they drink it. Someone always asks, what does it taste like to you? And I was like, tastes like tasty chemicals. It just happens to be bright orange.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me, in some ways it's parallel to like banana flavored candy. I'm not saying it's the same flavor, but banana flavored candy, when you eat that, it doesn't taste like bananas.
It tastes like an artificial banana.
Yeah, like banana flavored candy is a different thing than even banana flavor, like banana taste. So it's almost like that. So it kind of throws you off when you eat it. You're expecting orange, I guess.
What is amazing is Iron Brew sorbet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What? It's very sharp. and sorbet, if you don't know, it's like a frozen liquid that you can have that instead of ice cream, it's meant to be better for you. but it's very sharp and hits those, you know, back of the mouth type texture.
Yeah, I'm picturing like an Iron Brew Icy or something like that. If they had those at the movie theater or something.
You can get Iron Brew. So I like Iron Brew so much that for, I think it was my 30th birthday, I had an Iron Brew cake.
Okay. Did it taste like Iron Brew?
I don't think it did. I think it was chocolate inside with Iron Brew all over it. But yeah, all I'm going to say is I have found a local store that will sell Iron Brew at $2 a bottle, which for British people, that's about £1.50. Okay. And I am ecstatic because the only other place I could find it, it was $5 a bottle.
That's crazy.
And I don't have that budget.
It's not that good.
It's not that good. Easy.
It's not $5.
Can we go back to
Art's? Pay $5
let's go back to Art's question about those that drink Iron Brew and those that don't.
You know what? I'm going to start bringing in cases just for me and drink it in front of me and see what happens. All right. Those are some good questions. If you want to submit a question to the mailbag, you can wait for a social media invitation, or you can send a question anytime at mailbag@ftc.co. The email address is mailbag@ftc.co. And if you enjoy the podcast, dear listener, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.
You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.